This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In this season of national argument over same-sex marriage, we're taking a look at two historical controversies over marriage and the law. Yesterday we heard about polygamy. Today, racial intermarriage, or miscegenation, as it was called. From the earliest colonial times until the 1960s, the marriage of two people of different races was illegal in much of the country. Historian Peggy Pascoe, who teaches at the University of Oregon in Eugene, says laws against intermarriage were the longest-lasting form of legal racial discrimination in America.
They were in effect in 30 states, every southern state, the vast majority of western states, some of the states on the border like Indiana. And they weren't declared unconstitutional until 1967, when the U.S. Supreme Court finally issued its famous decision, Loving versus Virginia.
Until that time, there actually was a law in Virginia that made it illegal for a white and a black to marry.
There was. In all the states that had these laws, there were prohibitions on marriages between whites and blacks. But that was not the extent of the prohibitions. A dozen states prohibited whites from marrying Asian Americans. A dozen more prohibited whites from marrying Indians. 9 states prohibited whites from marrying Filipinos. And even that wasn't the end of it. Arizona prohibited whites from marrying Hindus. My own state of Oregon prohibited whites from marrying Native Hawaiians.
Now, while there are some analogies between what happened with miscegenation laws and with same-sex marriage and the controversy arising now, there seems to be at least one dimension that was unique to this history of the law in America, and that was the problem of defining who was white or who was black or who was Indian. That wasn't always obvious to people in court.
No, it wasn't obvious at all. And in fact, quite a number of court cases hinge right on that issue. The courts assumed that the laws were constitutional, that they were consistent with the guarantee of equal protection. And consequently, the only exceptions they made to them were in cases where people could persuade them that they had been miscategorized racially.
And in several cases, say a man who had been married for some years to a woman, it had seemed legally, now claimed that he wanted out and could point to the fact that his wife was not either white or completely white to say the marriage should be annulled and I should be absolved of my responsibilities to her.
The most heart-wrenching ones, I think, happen when white men who are married either to black or Indian women die and their white relatives go to court claiming that there had never been a marriage at all and use miscegenation law to declare those marriages void and take the inheritance and property for themselves.
There are a couple of interesting kinds of challenges raised to these laws. One of them was somebody would say, well, I am part of African blood, part American Indian blood, say part Caucasian blood. Under the law, I actually can't marry anyone.
That was the case in Arizona, and there was a similarly complicated one-drop law in Virginia.
This is one drop of blood.
It is. Most states that defined race explicitly in these years, and all southern states did so by defining a set percentage of what they called black blood. And that percentage might be 1/8 black blood, or it might be one drop black blood. And the tighter laws were the one drop laws.
As you said, at least, I guess, 30 states had miscegenation laws that made this illegal. But that meant there always were states where it wasn't illegal.
Yes, and over time, what that meant was that couples who wanted to marry learned a sort of geography of evasion. And if they wanted to try to marry, they would learn which states they could go to and find licensing clerks that would issue them licenses, and then they would return to their own state. That did not always provide the protection that they wanted. It wouldn't necessarily defend them from an inheritance case or other kinds of legal challenges, but it did, in many cases at least, give them marriage licenses.
This could ultimately serve as some historical precedent for what we're about to see if different states treat same-sex marriage very differently. Typically, I mean, do states set aside their own view of marriage in order to honor another state's laws, or typically not?
Well, in the case of miscegenation law, most state marriage codes had provisions that said that a state would ordinarily recognize as valid marriages made in other states. And a couple of states, California was one of them, upheld that even when it came to miscegenation law. But the vast majority of states found ways to make exceptions to that policy.
The couple who ultimately brought the successful Supreme Court challenge to the Virginia law, the Lovings, were in fact a Virginia couple who had had to get out of Virginia and live in the District of Columbia in order to avoid enforcement of the miscegenation law.
They had been sent out of the state by the judge who prescribed as punishment that they would, in essence, not be allowed to return to the state of Virginia.
And at some point, they just decided, we've had it, we're going to challenge for our right to live in the state we come from.
They were away for, I believe it was 5 years, quite a long time, and then were finally fed up.
Having studied the history of miscegenation laws, and now witnessing along with the rest of us the movement claiming the right to same-sex marriage, what to you, if anything, is instructive or parallel about the prior experience with what we're seeing right now?
Well, there are lots of parallels. Both kinds of laws function in the same way. They attempt really to ground some form of discrimination, whether by race or gender, in the fundamental social bedrock of marriage law. And the arguments on both sides are surprisingly similar. Opponents of same-sex marriage say that same-sex marriage is either unnatural or contrary to God's will. And on the other side, supporters base their arguments on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, thus echoing the position the U.S. Supreme Court took when it declared miscegenation laws unconstitutional. I think the most interesting historical development is that courts have recently begun to credit those equal protection analogies, beginning with a famous case in Hawaii in the 1990s and continuing into the Massachusetts case decided just this year. Courts have begun to take that analogy very seriously.
Well, Professor Pascoe, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Robert.
Peggy Pascoe, historian at the University of Oregon.